Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining us on the roundtable today, we have Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Sarah.
Hey, happy Monday.
And Ohio Capital Journal reporter Marty Schladen. Welcome back, Marty.
Good morning, Amy.
And Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Laura.
Good to be here.
There are a couple of updates on the marijuana front, so let's start there. It's been more than a year, but communities across Ohio are finally starting to receive their promised tax revenue from the recreational marijuana sales. The ballot initiative the voters passed was in November of 2023, and it called for a percentage of tax marijuana sales to go back to local communities that host dispensaries. It's more than $35 million, and it's being divided amongst 100 communities. So, Sarah, we could start with you. Why is it taking so long for this money to reach people and places?
So this was really a bargaining chip for lawmakers because it was passed as part of issue two, as you said, that these communities that chose to host dispensaries, they'd get kickbacks from the government. They'd get money, tax money for hosting those dispensaries. But the state argued that there wasn't really the mechanism to actually distribute the money in issue two. So when lawmakers were going back and forth about how they were going to change marijuana laws over the last two or so years, this funding piece, this local government funding piece, was held up in it. And it's really a win for local governments who lobbied to get this money, because for a while, the governor and some Republican lawmakers were advocating that they reallocate that money, that they get rid of that 36% host community fund and instead put it toward, you know, state public safety or other state funds. General pockets of money that the state doles out. So it ended up getting preserved 100% in the way that it was in issue two, which I don't know, I would have expected a year ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, back in November, Columbus City Council President Shannon Hardin turned to social media with a message that said, "We can't wait forever." He referenced federal funding cuts and that he wanted his money. So in the end, Columbus received the most of any city, but Columbus has 20 dispensaries. So Columbus got $4.7 million. The so-called host community cannabis fund, which Sarah mentioned, has been the topic of debate. So, Laura, you know, as Sarah was just saying, lawmakers wanted to eliminate it or lower it, but didn't they basically just wanted the money for themselves? Is that right?
Yeah. And then, you know, they would argue that there were other needs. Like, for instance, for a while, there was a idea a couple of years ago being bantered around about sending the money to create a jail fund, like a stable funding for county jails, because there really isn't one at this point. However, I know that advocates for the legalization of recreational said that was kind of like the opposite, because they were hoping for like these larger social justice goals by legalizing recreational marijuana. So by like taking the money for like incarceration, that was kind of the opposite of their goals. So yeah, and with that city money, it's carte blanche. I mean, they can spend it on whatever they want, and they're doing all sorts of things with it, just kind of depending on the city.
Yeah, Kendall Crawford for the Ohio Newsroom wrote about the distribution of the money, and she noted some small towns that got big payouts in comparison. So an example she gave was Wintersville, a village in Jefferson County in the Steubenville area, which received nearly $900,000. But Wintersville only has 3,000 people. Does anyone know, were you following any of these smaller communities? Do you know how that's possible? Did they have sales that were like through the roof in little Wintersville?
Wintersville has the first, I know, marijuana dispensary that opened to the public. So they may very well may have had their ducks in a row to have one of the first recreational dispensaries open. And it might be one of the area's only recreational dispensaries, simply because a lot of the rural areas of Ohio, I know that access has been an issue. There's a lot of communities that don't have it. And there's also a lot of marijuana companies who do the economics, you know, they do the numbers and they don't think it's worth it to open a dispensary in a small town.
Yeah, Sarah.
It's really interesting because you see kind of this mix of like what Laura was saying. Some rural communities that have put moratoriums in place, they say we don't want a dispensary in our community. But then other rural communities that lean very conservative, especially down in Southeast Ohio, embracing the marijuana industry, seeing it as another form of a way to bring in tax revenue and saying, you know, maybe I talked to one county commissioner about a year ago. Who said, I didn't really like the idea of marijuana being legalized, but, you know, this is something that people want to buy. And that's why I think there was such a fight to preserve this host community.
Yeah, I also wonder about, like, so Wintersville is near Steubenville. So maybe there aren't very many dispensaries. So everyone all up and down that eastern border of Ohio is having to drive to Steubenville.
And of course, our home state of Pennsylvania has not legalized recreational marijuana yet.
Just
so
a quick 15-minute trip across the border.
You know, when we talk about the Michigan effect and folks in Ohio going to Michigan to get cheaper legal marijuana. But of course, you look at another neighboring state, huge neighboring state, Pennsylvania, that has not legalized recreational marijuana.
And my understanding is with Pennsylvania's medical marijuana program, you guys might want to correct me, but I thought they can only sell like plant flower. They can't sell edibles. They can't sell.
I don't know exactly, but it's very restrictive. I know that. Yeah.
I just wanted to make the point. You know, I came up through small newspapers, and I've covered more local government than I care to even think of. And these are units that have been starved for money forever. You know, like I've been in small towns in southeastern Ohio. They've got road projects they just can't do because they don't have money. And I believe that the actions of the legislature over the past decade or so has defunded them even further. So I think that's a big reason why they're getting so worked up about this. They need the money.
Yeah. Kendall Crawford for the Ohio Newsroom also talked with Holly Bartone, a city administrator for Painesville Township, who said that they received $500,000, and that now means her city can avoid putting a fire levy before voters.
Our goal is to prolong the need for asking for additional money from our residents. So we'll be earmarking the majority, if not all, of that additional revenue to help fund the fire department.
Yeah. So they had to wait a long time for this money, but now they're putting it to good use for their community. So that's what you were saying, Laura, is that they can use it for whatever they want, right?
And so, yeah, that's why I think a lot of these communities were frustrated that it took so long because the way that the initiated statute was written, according to the Department of Taxation, they did not create a funding mechanism for the money to be transferred to the cities. They just said this shall happen, which apparently wasn't enough. So, which is why they needed the legislature to act.
Now, let's circle back just for a minute to those communities that are not embracing dispensaries, even with the sales tax money. The Moritz College of Law Drug Enforcement and Policy Center lists 127 active moratoriums as of 2 weeks ago. That's when they did their last count. So do these represent different types of municipalities, or like, do you know what kind of communities have moratoriums on not, like, they don't want a dispensary in their area?
I think most cities, for the most part, mm-hmm. have wanted marijuana. I think suburbs is hit and miss. And then I noticed, okay, the first time the Moritz College of Law came out with a study, I wrote about it, and I got so many emails from townships saying they didn't include us in the study. Mm-hmm. So I know a lot of townships are like, heck no, we're not going to have the wacky tabacky.
So. Based on this latest study, it looks like the vast majority of them are smaller townships and jurisdictions. You know, they have 73 in townships or, even villages, because I think if it's under 5,000 is a village, of 0 to 10,000 population. And when you get to cities of 50,000 and more, there's 7. So definitely, I mean, Ohio also obviously has more small villages and townships than they have big cities like Columbus. But it's certainly these smaller communities and maybe suburbs that are enacting these moratoriums.
But Marty, back to what you said, I mean, these communities need the money, so they have to pick whether they want marijuana or they want the sales tax money.
Yeah, you have that clash between your ideology or your idea of what's good for the community and what your needs are. And I think it's important to remember that there are downsides with legalized marijuana. It's a lot stronger than it used to be. it's a lot more available, so young people are using it. I understand that their ER visits are up because people eat a bunch of edibles and they don't know what the heck they're doing. So, I mean, I can understand why if I'm a town father or mother, I'm thinking, you know, do I really want this in my community? But then, yeah, you know, then you got to pay for government some other way.
Yeah, $500,000 for instead of a fire levy. That's something. This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Marty Schladen from the Ohio Capital Journal, Laura Hancock from Cleveland.com, and Sarah Donaldson from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. I wanted to move to intoxicating hemp for a minute because there's a debate there still. There's an effort to repeal the new law that which hasn't taken effect yet. It goes into effect in mid-March. Lawmakers carved out an exemption for THC and CBD beverages, but Governor DeWine used his line item veto power in December to squash that. Who knows the latest on the repeal effort there? Sarah, do you?
Yeah, I can probably take that one. I know later on today, the campaign to repeal Senate Bill 56, they're called No on Senate Bill 56. They're officially launching their signature drive here in Columbus. But basically, immediately after Senate Bill 56 was passed, and that was, like you said, this big, big law making changes to hemp law, making changes to marijuana law, took 2-something years to pass. After that passed, this group basically came out immediately and said, we're going to try and get this repealed. You have an interesting little bit of a turf war going on here because, you know, a big motivation for trying to get this repealed is that intoxicating hemp portion. These are retailers, whether they're holistic wellness stores, whether they're gas stations that are selling intoxicating hemp and won't be able to anymore. And there's a whole federal piece because the federal government's trying to make that illegal as well, which is why state lawmakers have said they moved in the way they did. Now, of course, Governor Mike DeWine has wanted intoxicating hemp banned for years. But you've got that piece. You do have, I would say, some cannabis advocates more so on the consumer side who are pushing for this repeal as well. They have frustrations with the law in that it recriminalizes marijuana possession in certain circumstances. So, for example, something that folks have cited is that the bill, you know, you can't transfer edibles from their original packaging. It suddenly becomes illegal. You have to keep it in the trunk if it's an edible. There's these different little provisions in Senate Bill 56 that they say recriminalize marijuana possession. But then on the other side of it, you have groups like the campaign that got issue 2 on the ballot, as well as the Ohio Cannabis Coalition. They're the trade group for marijuana dispensaries who were very supportive of Senate Bill 56 in the end. They lobbied really hard on it. They were happy with how it turned out, namely because it bans intoxicating hemp, because they see intoxicating hemp as unregulated and dangerous, but also it's directly competing with the licensed marijuana dispensaries in Ohio.
So this idea of repealing Senate Bill 56, for lack of a better name, because these bills don't have good names. So for it has a Laura and Marty, that it has a long way to go to make the ballot, though, because it's not there.
They're gathering signatures. You would know this better than me. They're gathering signatures. And then when's their deadline for that?
So they they're trying to make the November ballot, and it's kind of tricky with a repeal effort because if they can get enough signatures before the bill actually goes into effect, they can effectively pause the bill from going into effect until November when voters vote. However, they're on a really, really tight deadline to do that because Attorney General Dave Yost blocked their initial petition. He said it was misleading, so they had to go back, rewrite it, go through this period. So now they've got like about a month, less than a month to get like 200-something valid. I think it's 248,000 valid signatures in very specific counties. It's a very high goal to just make the ballot in November. I think their goal's in July. I think they have to actually.
I see. So they need to get all those signatures before March.
To pause the law
from
going into effect. It's more likely that it's going to go into effect, but then it may, once it goes before voters, that part is a little unclear still because we haven't done a repeal effort hasn't been actually to that point in a while. Of course, there were efforts to repeal HB 6. More recently, there were efforts to repeal Senate Bill 1, that Higher Education Act, but we haven't seen a real repeal effort go really far in a while. Marty's looking at me. He's got something to add.
I just want to point out a historical fact here. With the HB 6 repeal, it failed because the attorney general did exactly what he did in this case. He rejected the initial language, and then the timeline was so tight that they couldn't get it done. And the rule of thumb is, too, if you need 200 and some thousand signatures, those all have to be verified as, you know, registered voters. What they'll say is you want to collect twice as many because so many get disqualified. So it's a high mountain.
In like 3 or 4 weeks, they need to get 500,000 signatures.
Yes, and recent law changes, too, mean that they have to get a specific number in a specific number of counties. Like, they can't just go to Franklin County and collect, you know, half the county's signatures.
Do they have money, like, paid signature gatherers?
Yes, okay. Their spokesperson has said that they are hiring paid circulators. But an interesting point with that is, you know, we've seen the proliferation of ballot issues. There have always been ballot issues in Ohio, but especially since the success of the abortion amendment and the marijuana initiated statute, we've seen more and more groups who feel like they're not getting success with the state legislature, so they're just going straight to the ballot. So they're competing with all these other efforts that are collecting signatures. I'm talking about the property tax amendment, qualified immunity, all these equal rights amendment, all these different groups that also want to be on the ballot this year.
Well, speaking of someone else who wants to be on the ballot, I wanted to talk about property taxes before we take our break. Governor DeWine last week used a press event to talk about another potential ballot issue, and that is to abolish property taxes. This issue is not popular with lawmakers from both parties. So, Laura, why is it going forward?
There's a group of people who, a bunch of them are in Lake County, but they're kind of all over the state, who want to get rid of property taxes. You know, housing has gone up a lot, historic levels of house value increases. In some counties and in some areas, that means that your taxes that you pay to your school district and your library and everyone else has also gone up with it. It kind of, it's complex sort of how that works, but in some places, property taxes have gone up a lot and it's cost a lot of money. And so people would like to get rid of property taxes. Now, Governor DeWine and members of the legislature have said this is like really naive because the people who back this think that government should just get cut by billions of dollars once the property taxes go away. But they're saying, well, this is naive because you have all these like services that the state law, federal law requires you to provide. So where is the money for that going to come? And so you're probably just going to have to raise it in other ways. You're going to be raising income taxes. You're going to be raising sales taxes. And Governor DeWine just volunteered. And he a lot of times needs to be prodded, you know, to get information out of him. But he just was very, like, talkative and volunteered that taxes might go up. Sales taxes, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20%. Plus you'll have an increase in income taxes if the property taxes go away. So they're in the process of gathering signatures. They don't have paid circulators. This organization is relying on volunteers. Generally, to be successful, you need paid circulators. So I really don't know. They're not really sharing how many, you know, they have. They've declined when I've asked. So I don't know how successful they're being, but people are taking it seriously in case they do. You know, because in theory, if you run into them at your grocery store and they say, hey, you want to get rid of your property taxes? That sounds great. Everybody wants to save money. Governor DeWine says that the state needs to have a serious discussion, if this does get on the ballot, about what this could mean.
Yeah. And Marty, the idea of someone walking up to you outside of the grocery store, outside of the library and saying, do you want to get rid of property taxes? Sign here. I mean, that seems easy enough to get the signatures.
It seems like it might be. But, I think a lot of people understand that there's no free lunch, that, you know, of course, nobody likes paying taxes. But I think a lot of people are sophisticated enough to understand that you take this money out of one pot, you got to put it in another. Mm-hmm. And one thing I want to point out, too, with the sales tax component of that, if those go up, like the governor said, to 20%, that's extremely regressive because you're going to be paying that 20% if you're Lex Wexner sitting in New Albany or you're working at Walmart for $15,000 a year. That 20% is 20% no matter what.
Laura, you wrote about what other states do, right? Mm-hmm. Like, do they all have
high
property
taxes? Nobody has 20%. The highest I saw was, I think, if I remember right, like around 11%. And that was for sales tax. And then for income tax, most states we're moving toward a flat tax. Next year we'll have a flat tax here in Ohio. And our flat tax will be around, I think, less than 3%, which is low, 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 like among the lowest, I think, like the second lowest in the country. Not every state has an income tax, though. Now, with the states that have high income taxes, they often do it by tax brackets. And in places like California, it's up to 13% is what their income tax is. So, yeah. And I think that there's a lot of, like, if you have ever lived in a state that doesn't have an income tax or a sales tax, you know, it's interesting how other things cost more, or there's another source of revenue. So you might live in a state with a lot of oil and gas. Texas.
I lived in Florida. There's a whole different, like,
yeah,
there's tourism.
Yeah, yeah. And like when I lived in Wyoming, there was oil and gas and coal, and they paid all the bills, and so things were cheap. But, you know, Ohio doesn't have, I mean, I know they have resources, but they don't have at that level. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about name, image, and likeness money for high school athletes, or maybe even middle school athletes, too. And two lawmakers are saying, heck no to that. They introduced legislation to ban it. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And still with us today, we have Laura Hancock from Cleveland.com, Ohio Capital Journal reporter Marty Schladen, and Sarah Donaldson from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. I wanted to do a quick recap update on immigration and ICE issues, which is a big topic in Ohio the last couple of weeks. Last week came the reprieve that Haitians here in Ohio under temporary protected status designation can stay. And for how long, though, we don't know. The Trump administration is appealing that court decision that allowed Haitian immigrants with TPS to remain in the U.S. Lynn Tremonti is the executive director of the Ohio Immigration Alliance and is relieved that TPS remains, but says that doesn't mean that worries have gone away.
We already have the Border Patrol and ICE active around Ohio, and there's been a marked increase this year. Columbus, Cleveland, Cincinnati, there are masked agents with guns already driving around looking for people to arrest.
So I know that you were with Governor DeWine for a press event last week, probably unrelated to this, but was he asked about the Haitian community, about this stay that the judge issued? What did he say?
One of the interesting things that I didn't know that he shared is somebody asked how many Haitians have had children that are American citizens, and he said he didn't have an exact number, but he guessed it was based on births at the local hospital. It was around, I think, 1,300? Is that what he said? And I was shocked that many people. So there's 1,300 American citizens who Haitian people are going to have to make a decision if they leave the country, you know, if they should give their child to somebody else to raise in America.
Mm. Yeah, you know, the governor has been pretty vocal in the last couple of weeks and the last couple of months, but I think has taken an even harder stance in the last week or so that he believes it's a mistake for the federal government to revoke this temporary protective status. Of course, that's in stark contrast to Senator Bernie Moreno, one of Ohio's two U.S. senators, mm-hmm. who told me in an interview 2 weeks ago that he thinks that Haitians should have been self-deporting over the last year because they knew that this date was coming. But DeWine says, you know, the situation in Haiti is not better. It's the worst it's ever been, that, you know, gangs are shooting at planes as they, you know, come into Haiti. So if these folks are leaving the United States, they're probably not going back to Haiti.
And that's, I think, an inconsistency that the senator is engaging in. You know, he says, of course, it's temporary protected status. And so he says, this is temporary. And they've been here since 2010. It's time for them to leave. But that ignores that a part of that law also says that you have to go through a specific process and come to a finding that things have materially improved in the place that they're leaving. And everybody from the head of the UN on down says, if anything, Haiti's worse now than when the earthquakes happened back in 2010.
And that's essentially the heart of the federal case in federal court. It's not whether Haitians should go back per se, but whether Christine Noem followed the process of doing an analysis about whether Haitians and Venezuelans need to go back.
Was Governor DeWine asked, or did he mention anything about when he said he was getting mixed signals about increased ICE action in Ohio? Does he have any more information on that?
Yeah, he talked with my colleague Karen Kassler last week after the TPS decision came down, and it was his understanding based on the most recent conversations at that point that he had had with the federal government that there weren't necessarily plans for like massive action in Springfield immediately. So I want to be careful because I was not the one who talked to the governor. That was my colleague, Karen. But he had said all along that he was kind of getting mixed signals about whether ICE would descend upon Springfield. Now, of course, there are other big cities, Democratic-run cities like the city of Columbus that have huge populations of Haitians, of Somali immigrants, many of whom are American citizens because Somali immigrants, my apologies, started coming in the 90s. So many of them are American citizens at this point, but that's another immigrant group that the Trump administration has pushed to take TPS away from. So in terms of Springfield, DeWine did say he was getting mixed signals, and then he said he told Karen that, you know, it didn't seem like there was going to be this dissent. But of course, we're in this reprieve, and, you know, I think there's a hearing on Thursday for this case. This will probably go to the Supreme Court if it's not there already. So at some point, there will be a final decision, but this is just kind of a pause.
Yeah. There's 30,000 Haitians in Columbus. There's between 12 and 15,000 Haitians in Springfield. And also related to the Somali community versus the Haitian community, there's also a difference between having TPS, temporary protected status, and asylum, right? And those are two different immigration processes as well, which are complicated. But also, we had Emily Brown, the director of the Immigration Clinic at Ohio State's Moritz College of Law, on my show last week, and she said that the Ohio Bureau of Motor Vehicles said it would treat Haitians' driver's licenses as expired as of February 3rd, despite the TPS extension, because they have this card from the federal government that says it expired on February 3rd, so therefore their license, their driver's license in Ohio, expired on February 3rd. So she mentioned that this could prevent Haitians from driving to jobs if they don't want to get pulled over and have an expired license. I don't know if she said this on my show on Thursday. You talked to Governor DeWine on Thursday. I don't think this didn't come up, right?
No, it didn't. I mean, there are a lot of those types of questions, of course. You know, Laura brings up the incident that you're talking about. You've got all these babies who are American citizens who, you know, if a parent gets deported, what do you do with them? Of course, you know, the question of there's so many questions out there that I think both folks in Springfield as well as in other communities where there are folks on TPS are trying to figure out, including the governor, because as we've said all along today, he's been pretty supportive of this immigrant community in Springfield.
He also has a connection to Haiti because he and his wife fund a school there in the name of a daughter who died. And so because of that, they are in constant contact with people on the ground in Haiti, which is why he knows that Haiti is, you know, he says with experience that Haiti is in the worst place it's been for a long, long time.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Laura Hancock from Cleveland.com, Marty Schladen from the Ohio Capital Journal, and Sarah Donaldson from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Two lawmakers want to keep high school students and middle school students as well from earning money through name, image, and likeness deals, NIL deals. One of the sponsors is Representative Mike Odioso, who coached football at St. Xavier in Cincinnati. He is not a fan.
we're going to have this linkage from all this garbage that's going on with the colleges and with the mess that is a transfer portal. But the NIL garbage is going to go all the way down to seventh grade. Are we prepared to do that? I say we're not.
So he raises a point, that he doesn't want just average kids trying to play in middle school and high school to be playing like college students or pros. What about this? What is he saying about like banning NIL here?
I mean, this is big business. Mm-hmm. And so he's saying that especially middle school kids as young as seventh grade, they just can't handle it. They can't handle the money, can't handle the responsibility of entering into a contract with a major corporation.
I mean, a 12-year-old having a deal with like a sandwich shop is just crazy.
Yeah,
to me.
Having a job. Yeah, exactly. And that's the argument on the other side. Like, why can't a student babysit on the side, or why can't a student work at McDonald's on the side? How is this different? But they're saying no. They're saying that it takes the learning experiences out of sports. It takes the fun, the social growth, all that kind of stuff that you get from being in sports, and makes it kind of like a business. You have to remember that the people who are going to get name, image, and likeness deals, I mean, they're not like your average, you know, athlete. They are going to be like LeBron James level.
Yeah, this all started because of there's a high school student in Dayton, right? Okay, who had the opportunity for some deals as a high school student, mm-hmm. and wanted to take advantage of them.
Yeah, so his parents sued the state in Franklin County Court, and the judge put the Ohio High School Athletic Association's policy banning name, image, likeness on hold. And so then the Ohio, you know, the OHSAA came together and quickly came up with a process to allow under some circumstances students to, you know, make money on NIL deals. And that was passed, although the sponsors of this legislation noted that like 200 high schools did not vote. They abstained from the vote. Mm. And so they're saying that they believe that lots of schools do not want this to happen. It will be an interesting debate in the legislature.
Yeah. The Ohio High School Athletic Association said in a statement, they pointed out that Ohio is one of 45 states that allows some kind of NIL deal at the high school level. So 45 other states do it.
Yeah, but what the lawmakers point out is that most of these states allow NIL deals because their high school athletic associations have just decided for the whole state. And they think it's the job of the legislature to make that decision. Because out of those 45 states, I think only 5 of them, the legislature said, okay, let's do this.
Okay, so and in this bill, he's saying that an NIL ban would it would even the playing field, make room for an average kid, right? Is that what, like, the...
Yeah, and then they just don't want the big business. And then there's this other argument that I've heard, which is, like, really, really talented, like the LeBron James level high school athletes and middle school athletes, they'll just, like, move to Indiana or Pennsylvania or wherever. They'll just move to a nearby state that allows it. So... because they could make a little bit of money while they're in school, and they could, you know, maybe transfer to a school that has better athletics. So
that's so interesting, because that's kind of in the whole argument of NIL. Like, that's literally the same argument that you heard at the college level and how it trickled across the state so fast, because, you know, someone's not going to go to Ohio State because they can make money at this other big name school in another state.
Well, I guess we'll see what happens there. Coming up, we're going to talk about data centers and the ongoing debate about economic development versus what they mean for the communities they're in. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. This is the Week the Reporter Roundtable, and I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us today, we have Sarah Donaldson, a reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Ohio Capital Journal reporter Marty Schladen, and Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter with Cleveland.com. Data centers continue to be controversial as more communities are pushing back and lawmakers are looking for ways to encourage economic development, but also help communities too. Sarah, you wrote about this. The Senate Minority Caucus is looking at legislation to further regulate data centers. And here is Democratic Senator Kent Smith, who wants to end the tax credits for them.
There's some states that are getting more revenue with far less data centers. So this tax break, maybe this was a good idea 6 years ago, 8 years ago.
But then there's also, we have House Speaker Matt Huffman, who is not completely in agreement here about taking away the tax breaks.
We put in the budget a provision that removed the exemption for data centers on paying tax for the building materials. Everybody else has to build a building, they got to pay tax when they go down to the local lumber yard. I don't know how much lumber's in a data center, but you get the idea.
Okay. So, Sarah, what does Kent Smith and some other Democrats want to do when it comes to these tax breaks?
Well, I want to start off the top, Amy, because I want to clarify. Speaker Matt Huffman and Senator Kent Smith are actually looking for the same thing here. They are in agreement about this. So Democrats have introduced a slate of bills this GA, or they're working on a slate of bills that they plan to introduce this GA. And of course, we're halfway through the General Assembly. They say they want to require community investments by data centers, restrict their water usage, reaffirm local home rule on decision making about data centers, and other further regulations. You know, Democrats in the legislature introduce bills a lot of times that don't go anywhere because they don't have Republican support. But I do think that this is an issue that's become salient for Republicans as well. You see a lot of people in a lot of different communities who are not happy with these data centers. They feel they're a drain on resources and they don't want them in their communities. And so what Smith and Huffman were both talking about, there are different types of tax breaks that data centers can get. But one of the biggest of them is a 100% sales tax exemption on materials that they need to build data centers. So if a data center wants to build in Ohio, they can get a 100% sales tax exemption on all the materials to build. And, you know, Governor Mike DeWine has been really defensive of that exemption. The Chamber of Commerce has defended that exemption.
So DeWine would want to keep it. Is that what you're saying?
And okay. So the lawmakers in the budget last year, still this GA, they tried to get rid of the tax exemption. And Governor Mike DeWine overruled them. He vetoed that. So what Huffman was talking about
okay,
is...
Okay, I think I misunderstood what Huffman was talking about.
No, they're overruling Mike DeWine overruling something. They're floating a veto override. And I've heard this since last summer after Governor Mike DeWine vetoed the elimination of this sales tax exemption. There's a lot of negatives in this sentence.
You can still veto override. It seems like it's been a long time since the budget passed.
Anything, as a general rule of thumb, anything that Governor DeWine or a future governor vetoes in a budget, they have until the end of the General Assembly. And Ohio's under 2-year General Assembly. So they have till December to do it.
I didn't know that. Okay. So back to what you were saying. So Huffman could veto override to take away this 100% thing.
Yeah, and his issue with it, issue with it is he says, you know, everyone else who's starting a business, they have to pay taxes on lumber. And, you know, he says, I don't know how much lumber is in a data center, but all these other businesses, when they're starting, they have to pay sales taxes on the materials to build things. And Smith and him, and I've heard the same sentiment from other lawmakers, from lobbyists on both sides. You know, when Ohio was trying to attract these data centers maybe a decade ago, maybe 8 years ago, 6 years ago, those exemptions made sense. But there's a proliferation of data centers now in Ohio. So there's a question of how effective these tax exemptions really are.
Well, and yeah, and I want to point out, like, Kent Smith and his cut, you know, some of us say data, some of us say data, but either way, they're just, I was like, as he said it, because I said it one way, and then Kent Smith said it the other way, and then you said it a different way, and I was like, what is it, data or data? I need a grammar girl.
I think it's both. Yeah. I probably vacillate between the two, knowing myself.
Okay, so data or data centers, they're popping up all over the place, though, so this is a, like, this is a lot. And they're being, if they're already started to being built, they have these exemptions. So is this for future ones?
Yeah, I think the expectation is for future ones because there are other tax incentives that data centers can get in Ohio. For example, there's a job creation tax credit that a lot of different businesses can benefit from. They can apply. That's a state tax credit. Local governments for a long time were giving data centers tax abatements to build. But, you know, I think what's interesting about this is, again, Democrats are introducing all these bills. They don't have bipartisan support yet. But, you know, you've seen more and more Republicans voicing some concerns with them.
Marty?
Well, I just want to point out these data centers don't employ many people. So, you know, we're giving all these quote unquote incentives to create relatively few jobs. Policy Matter Ohio estimates that, at least in some instances, we're giving up $1 million worth of taxes for one job created. And this is something that ever since John Kasich was governor, the state government has done is they've handed out all of these tax incentives, billions and billions of dollars a year, supposedly to create jobs. Yet, you know, Ohio lags according to pretty much every measure. I'm still waiting to be convinced that this is just not more of the same.
And now we're also seeing some communities are pushing back where the data center is staking out a piece of land and they were like, nope, we don't want it here, right?
And you know, in addition to using a lot of water, they use a lot of electricity. Everybody knows that their electricity bills are spiking. It's just hard, at least from my perspective, to see how this is a big economic win for Ohio.
Well, and lawmakers are trying to do something about that, too, where they're making the data centers pay more of the electricity.
So that's actually, I mean, it's the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio's kind of lawmakers, but also regulators, really. You know, and that was a proposal by American Electric Power, AEP, which, of course, because there's data centers all over Ohio, but they really are. The most are in central Ohio, so AEP is the electric provider for a lot of folks in Ohio, both big consumers like data centers and little consumers like you and me. But they wanted these data centers to pay, I think, like 90% of the data they said they use, even if they don't use the energy. I think I said data, but you know what I mean. So it's that has I don't have I don't know where that proposal landed. I think it was moving forward. It's a long process with the PUCO. But the undercurrent is you have a lot of people asking, how can we make sure that these data centers have the same skin in the game that other power-hungry consumers have?
Well, and of course, because the people who operate the grid need to be able to plan. You know, if you're going to add capacity, that's very expensive. And if, you know, data center X says we're going to use all this power and then they end up not doing it, those expenses are going to land on us unless there's some provision made otherwise.
One more interesting point, and I don't want to go because I go into the weeds with this stuff, but one thing that lawmakers have cited that they've already passed is behind the meter generation. They argue that some of these big data centers could be, you know, basically paying to generate their own energy that goes directly to them. So they loosened some restrictions on behind the meter in a big energy proposal that they passed last year. The governor signed it. So, you know, interesting to see if that's a route. It's, you know, it's a newer data centers, they've been around, but it's definitely, they propose a different question than like big manufacturing proposes, you know?
With AI, they're growing exponentially.
Yeah. They're needed for AI to run and function, right? Until we figure out a way to make them smaller, which I've talked on our weekly Tech Tuesday segment several times where it was like, just give us 5 years and it'll probably don't need as big of a building.
Well, and that's a wild card, right? I mean, like quantum computing is becoming a thing. Technology's moving so rapidly now, it's really hard to predict where we're going to be in a decade.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Sarah Donaldson from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Marty Schladen with the Ohio Capital Journal, and Laura Hancock from Cleveland.com. Marty, you wrote about a mismatch between Ohio's education system and workplace training. This is based on a survey of economists. What are some of the concerns being raised here that you wrote about?
Well, their basic concern was that what we're doing in terms of public education here in Ohio is not, you know, meeting up with what employers at least say they want. And that probably would be true no matter, you know, whether we had doubled or tripled down on charter schools the way we have and school vouchers and that sort of thing. But what was interesting to me is we've, over the last 15 years, 20 years in Ohio, we've radically altered how we do public education, yet we're still in this place where, you know, this group of economists anyway believes we're still not, you know, producing kids who are what employers say they want.
You also noted in your piece that Ohio's ranking when it comes to education overall has fallen. It's also ranked lower for educational attainment.
That's just how much school you've completed.
Okay. And so years of education received. Is that what that means?
Yeah.
Okay. So what does that mean for us if Ohio's education ranking falls?
Well, I mean, employers, I know one thing they definitely want you. I'm sure they want you to be able to do quantum computing when you show up, but they at least want you to be able to read and write and communicate clearly and have the basics of an education. And then, you know, for example, I was on the business desk at the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette and I interviewed ITT is based in Fort Wayne, but they had a campus in Thousand Oaks, California. And I asked the CEO why, and he goes, because that's where the talent pool is. That's where the people, we've got these people who went to Caltech and all that sort of thing. And unfortunately, they don't want to move to Fort Wayne. So, you know, we need to produce, you know, for certain jobs, people who've got these upper level technical skills that it takes to do them.
Laura, I wanted to ask you about a couple education things you were writing about. There's a bill to pay student teachers, and there's a shortage of student teachers and teachers in general. So where is this bill? Because I feel like it came up before and then went nowhere.
So earlier this year, there was a bill. However, the Republican sponsor left to take a job at the U.S. Department of Education. And then the Democratic sponsor who has left got some more information and decided to kind of rejigger the bill. And so they decided to just introduce a new bill. So this is a new bill with a new Republican co-sponsor. And what it would do is it would allow school districts to choose to pay at least minimum wage, $11 an hour, to teachers, and if they want, give them health insurance. This is totally optional. State of Ohio could choose to reimburse teachers for their licensing exams, and colleges could choose to give students breaks, on the classes they take while they're student teaching. So they say that this would make it more competitive for people to go into education because, you know, it's not the best paying profession. So little incentives like this can mean everything.
And there's another bill you wrote about where it would penalize school districts for suing over vouchers. Where is that? You're chuckling. Yeah.
Brand new bill.
Yeah. Okay.
And so we have over 300 school districts that are in a coalition who are suing the state over vouchers. And so if the bill, theoretically, if it became law, then basically all the money that would normally go to the schools, the state money, would be held in escrow until they dropped it on the lawsuit. I mean, this bill is clearly a statement bill by the legislature. It's probably unconstitutional. It'd probably get thrown out. School districts say that they've hired lobbyists, that they've, you know, gone to the governor every time a new school choice bill comes up. They have pleaded with legislators. Nobody's listening, so they have to use the judicial branch to see if they can get what they want. And it's not just – it is directed at the charter school lawsuit, but it would be anybody suing over the state funding scheme for education.
I have a real hard time seeing how that is constitutional. Yeah. I mean, this is the United States. You can sue anybody for anything.
Yeah. Okay. And then, Sarah, one other – I'm running through bills here before we run out of time. Since the start of the new session, there's been a lot of bills introduced, but one that kind of has a hitting the headlines feel to it, it would penalize people who interrupt church services. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so this is a Republican-backed bill that came out of a protest in Minneapolis. There was a protest at a church because allegedly one of the pastors at this church also worked as an ICE field director. So there were anti-ICE protesters who disrupted a Sunday service, stormed in, protested. That was the protest that Don Lemon was arrested after the fact. I don't want to get into the details. I was not covering it, but you know, Republican Representative Tex Fisher saw the viral videos online and told me he felt that Ohio needed to raise the penalties. Interestingly enough, the state actually raised the penalties for disrupting a religious service just a couple years ago in 2023. That came after a spate of anti-Semitic protests at Zoom services, like Jewish Zoom church Jewish services, as well as a protest at the downtown Catholic church. There were some abortion rights protesters who stormed in and disrupted a Respect Life mass. So lawmakers took those protests in 2020, 2021, and made it a first-degree misdemeanor to disrupt a religious service. And that was a bipartisan bill. Governor DeWine signed it in 2023. But again, Fisher's now saying it should be brought to a felony. So
it raises it from a misdemeanor to a felony.
Yes, which obviously there are, you know, different complications when it comes to being charged with a felony. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we'll see where it goes. No Democratic support right now. But of course, you know, Republicans are in the supermajority. So if enough of them feel that it needs to be raised again, we'll see.
All right. We're going to leave it there. I want to say thank you to Sarah Donaldson with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
And Laura Hancock with Cleveland.com. Thank you.
Thank you.
And with the Ohio Capital Journal, Marty Schladen. Thank you, Marty.
Thanks, Amy.
And this has been the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.